Okay, please join Supervisor Crisp in the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Heavenly Father, we're grateful to be here this morning. We thank you for our government and its thoughtfulness of our community, for those who participate today in sharing and reporting. We thank you for their work. We're truly grateful that people are committed to serving this community and this county. And Father, we just express our gratitude again for the continued moisture and the rain. And may we know and understand how blessed we are. And we give you thanks for all things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you. Wendy?
All righty. Supervisor Hupp?
Present.
Supervisor Cobstaff?
Here.
Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yep.
Supervisor Ogren? And Supervisor Crisp?
Present in person.
Thank you.
Okay, this is time for presentations from the...
My little announcement, I'm sorry. The board will be convening today as the Flood Control and Water Conservation District and receives no additional compensation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, this is time for presentations from the public. This time slot is for information from the public. No action or discussion will be conducted on matters presented at this time. You'll be allowed 3 minutes. I don't see any...
I have no
blue cards. Anyone have public comment? Anyone online?
Showing online.
Nice. We'll move right along to item 5, which is our consent agenda. Anything from the board?
That I can pull from item 5B is in boy and H.
Anyone else?
Move to approve the balance of the consent agenda.
Second, when you want to do it?
Yes. Okay. Supervisor Hupp?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobstaff?
Aye.
Supervisor Crisp?
Aye.
Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
And Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yep.
Thank you.
Item B, please.
Item B. I don't know who that would be, but I'm just in... I can't support this, so that's just where I'm at. I understand it's a court order, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to me after 8 or 10 years of going through this on an EIR and then have it thrown. So, anyway.
Okay. Then with that, I'll make the recommended motion.
I'll second.
Ready?
Okay, Supervisor Hupp?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobstaff?
No.
Supervisor Crisp?
Aye.
Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
And Supervisor Valenzuela?
Okay.
All
right. Item H, Supervisor Cobstaff?
Item H. Each year this comes up and it grows every year, and I know why. It's a salary bit, but... I'm still, I guess, each year I ask this question or try to. We pay for one full-time staffing at Hornbrook, and I know why we pay for the communication part of that. I understand that, but I just don't understand why we continue to pay for the one firefighter position.
Angela Davis, County Administrator. I will look into that with the Chief Darrell Loss.
Okay.
I was hopeful that he would be online, and he's not at this time. So I can definitely ask that question and get back to you.
Supervisor,
I believe we had this discussion a couple of years ago about the Amador agreement, mm-hmm. and the need to, because the Lumber Fire Protection District can't come up with certification on responsibility.
About
the position. Hornbrook Cal Fire Station covers when they're short staffed. Unless I'm incorrect in that.
Perhaps we can have an agenda item with Cal Fire here. I think I hear what you're saying, but why don't we do that throughout the county? I think this goes under my soapbox about we should have a county fire department instead of Cal Fire and all the little mom and pop operations. Particularly in the environment that we're in. So I think it does warrant an agenda item at some point. Supervisor Cobstaff, do you want to make a motion?
Yeah, I'll move to approve.
Second.
Ready?
All righty. Supervisor Howe?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobbsett?
Aye.
Supervisor Chris?
Aye.
Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
And Supervisor Valenzuela?
Sure. We're going to move on to item six, public request, Pacific Power. Presentation regarding vegetation management program for Siskiyou County and the 2023 plan.
Chair and Supervisors, thank you for giving us some time. I presented with some assistance, great assistance, about early last or late last year, Todd Andrews, Pacific Power.
Thank you.
I apologize. With our wildfire mitigation efforts, and a question came up with our vegetation management. So what I want to do is present to you today Lorelei Phillips, who does our vegetation management in this area. She has 20 years of experience, 16 with Pacific Power, and I won't go any farther with that, but Lorelei Phillips has a quick presentation for you, and we'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
All right, good morning, everybody. My name is Lorelei Phillips. I'm a senior forester with Pacific Power. I cover Southern Oregon and Northern California. I've been in utility vegetation management for almost 28 years now, and about 15 to 16 years with Pacific Power. My prior engagement was actually on the other side of California at Pacific Gas and Electric for about 12 years, kind of over in the Humboldt, Trinity, and Mendocino counties. I've been a certified arborist for about 25 years, a utility specialist arborist, and then also a tree risk assessment qualified hazard tree specialist. Next slide. All right, so I'm going to go into a little bit of the history of wildfires and how they changed regulations in California. So I don't know if a lot of you remember, but back in 2007, there were some catastrophic wildfires more in the Southern California area that were driven by the Santa Ana winds. And the CPUC became really active in creating a lot of legislation. And they also developed this map that you see on the screen. And this map impacts Siskiyou County too. And what they did is they created high fire threat district areas. And so if you look at the yellow area, that's an area of elevated risk, so that's tier two. And then tier three is what they consider areas of extreme risk, and that is the red areas on the map. So look at the next slide. And then if you drill into Siskiyou County, the orange area is actually most of Siskiyou County, and we are in the tier two elevated area. So it goes mostly into Syed, Happy Camp, Scott Bar, and that area, and then a lot of areas that are outside of kind of the Weed Shasta area. And so most of the Siskiyou County is in a level two, like an elevated type area. And then the Mount Shasta and Weed area, and then down into North Dunsmuir, is considered more of the tier three or the extreme fire threat area. And we have about, I'm gonna say about 2,000 line miles inside the high fire threat district areas. And about 400 of those miles are inside the higher extreme area, which is the Weed, Mount Shasta, and Dunsmuir area. We'll go to the next slide. So another thing that took place, in 2017, the CPUC really started to step up, and they added some additional regulations. And this was under General Order 95, Rule 35. And they submitted this table, and what it did is it set forth the minimum clearances that vegetation can have from the power lines. And so most of the lines that you see, like in the picture around Siskiyou County, are right around the 12,000 kilovolts. And so the minimum clearance that we can have from the power lines is 4 feet from any trees or vegetation. And then the next column over is their post-recommended clearances, so 12 feet is what the CPUC recommends after the pruning is conducted. And as you go up in voltages, you can see that the minimum the clearance distances increase, and also the post-pruning clearances. So if you get up near the, you know, the transmission type, kind of higher voltage, the clearances that we must maintain and then also prune on the trees increase. And Pacific Power's specifications actually exceed a lot of these recommendations by the CPUC. And what we do is we look at the growth rates of the trees specifically. So if they're moderate to fast growing or a little bit fast grower, we're going to get more than that 12 feet. We're going to probably recommend 14 to 16 feet. And the reason that we're doing that is because we want to maintain the clearance outside of that minimum of 4 feet. So it's kind of hard to explain, but sometimes the trees grow so fast after they're pruned that they have that capability to grow back towards that minimum clearance that we're supposed to maintain. So Pacific Forest specs are usually a little bit greater than the CPUC or some of the CAL FIRE recommendations, just to make sure that we stay in compliance with the laws.
Can I interrupt you for a minute?
Yeah.
So you see that pole is leaning into, because it's got a side pole with that secondary. So how does that affect your, you're just going to cut the tree even though the pole's leaning?
Right, so typically if we have any kind of leaning poles or where we see issues and we're on the vegetation inspection, we have a database and we can mark that pole and send it to our line department, and then they send out a specialist that's more involved within the line construction, and they'll take a look at it and assess it and determine if it needs to be pulled up or what needs to be done.
I mean, I think, to me it's obvious it's leaning. I don't know if it is to most people.
Right,
you know, where
right.
I'm going with this is that, you know, what I think you're going to be up against is a lot of people are going to, you're not touching my tree.
Right, and typically we have a refusal process that we go through, and we have a lot of laws in California through the CPUC, so we ultimately end up pruning every tree. So I've been on the ground here for 16 years, and I've had a lot of refusals where I've actually had to stand on site where the customer is refusing to allow clearance. And typically, if it gets to the point where they refuse us altogether, we go through legal channels, we send out a legal letter. Often at times, too, if it becomes an aggressive action from the customer, then we actually have a deputy that will support us on site, too. So ultimately, every tree we end up performing the clearance. And that tree right there is a post-clearance picture. So we have about 12 to 14 feet on that tree.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, anytime.
Good follow-up. So if you do get a refusal and there is a fire that ensues, can that private residence also be liable?
You say that again, sir.
Can that person also be liable during the refusal may have started the fire?
Yeah, they can be. Typically what we do, though, is we work through that process to prevent that. So typically if we do have a person that refuses it, there's certain laws now, too, that just came into place a couple years ago with the CPUC, and if that tree is jeopardizing that minimum clearance, we can shut their power off too. We don't like to do that. It's a last resort, but that is a course that we can take, is we can actually have a power shut off until they comply with it. And we have a really good tree removal replacement program too, so we kind of go the PR way too, and we say, hey, if your tree is really a problem, we're having to prune it every year, let's look at some removal replacement options and maybe look at some power line friendly type trees that won't get as tall, or we can plant something farther away from the conductors. So we kind of have different parts of the program that help us get through some of the rough spots like that. So
I would think that it's pretty extreme for that to get to that point. Most of it's pretty.
Yes. I want to say in Siskiyou County, I've probably had, in the past 16 years, maybe 6 to 8 where I've had to have a deputy on site with me. And it's typically because of they're refusing to have the work done, but they're also being aggressive, posing a threat to either myself or the tree company. So most of the time, we work through these.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And what's your time frame for that process to happen? Is it a year? Is it a cycle? Is it?
It's pretty quickly. So, you know, it's kind of funny. I'm standing on site in Wairika today on refusal. So once our inspectors go through and they have a customer that refuses work, it comes to us automatically, the foresters, through our database. So they can basically auto-email a record stating that the customer is refusing to have the work done. And then usually within 2 to 3 weeks of resolving that, we try and make contact as soon as possible within maybe a week or two. and then we kind of go forward with trying to meet them on site, and then the pruning will definitely take place within the next, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. If it's imminent, let's say it's contacting the conductors or it's a hazard tree that could fail and hit the lines, we move really quick. And there's been times in the past, if it's an imminent hazard, I'll just bring a tree crew out there and we'll deal with the situation or the condition, and then we'll deal with the customer afterward. Because we take that very seriously. We don't want anything to happen. So.
Okay.
All right, that's thank you. I'm glad it's finally went through yesterday. So in relation to the regulations that have been set, all the utilities in California were required to develop a wildfire mitigation plan. And in response to that, what we have decided to do at Pacific Power is actually do an annual inspection on all the areas that are in the high fire threat districts. So now we're on these circuits every single year. We used to be on a 2x4 cycle on some of these circuits, but because of our commitment to our wildfire mitigation plan, we're now on these circuits every single year, which is great, because a lot of you probably see trees are dying fairly quickly with the drought, so we want to be able to pick this up very quickly and not have a year or two gap. So on these annual inspections, and when we're performing the work, we're looking for trees on the left picture that could jeopardize that minimum 4 feet clearance. And then we're also looking for hazard trees, so dead, dying, defective type trees that could fall and hit the conductors. And a lot of people think it's just dead or dying trees that we're looking for, but hazard trees can be codominant stems, multiple top trees, trees that are leaning really heavy, trees that have decay. So the inspection is a little more thorough than you would think just looking for a dead tree. And we also have trees that are impacted by environmental factors like slides and drought and wildfires. So we're looking out for that too as we go through our inspections. So that's kind of what we're doing differently with our new wildfire mitigation plan, is we're doing the annual inspection and the work also.
Most of the pictures are kind of urban. What about large, vast tracts of public land and things you traverse? How often is that inspection done?
That's every year, too.
Is it on the ground or by air?
It's on the ground, yes. And then further on in the presentation, I'll show you some slides, too, of where we do aerial patrols in the helicopter. Mm-hmm. And that's over the higher voltage transmission that goes in between the substations. Yeah, so we all these circuits run everywhere between Wairika, Happy Camp, into Klamath National Forest, BLM. So those are scheduled annually also. That next slide. All right, and beyond our annual mitigation fire work, we still also conduct our routine cycle work. So we are on every circuit every 3 years. So if we're not hitting it annually for the fire mitigation work, we're going to hit it every 3 years. And on that cycle work, we're also looking for dead, dying, or defective hazard trees that can strike the lines. We're pruning trees that are within certain work thresholds that could impact that minimum 4 feet clearance. And then one thing we do differently on the three-year cycle is we're actively pursuing smaller trees and brush on that third picture underneath the lines. And what we're trying to do is remove the vegetation underneath the lines to prevent it from growing up into the power lines. And what's really good about that is we're trying to prevent future maintenance, because if we leave the trees under the lines, they're just going to continue to grow up towards the conductors, and we're going to have to prune them, and it costs money. So anyways, that's a really good practice on our cycle work. And then we also look at, I don't have a picture of it, but we look at our secondaries on cycle work. So those are the service drops that go into your home. So we look for anything that could be deflecting that service drop or causing a problem with the secondary. That's that. So pole clearing, sometimes people don't see this, but this is something that Pacific Power also conducts, and we clear vegetation in a 10-foot radius at the base of the pole. And this is only on poles that have non-exempt equipment. So the pictures on the left are examples of certain fuses or connectors. And if they fail, they have the ability to spark. And so CAL FIRE actually has been the agency that has designated what is non-exempt, or they tell us what equipment has the ability to spark. And it's actually located in their power line wildfire prevention manual. So we've been clearing on CAL FIRE regulated areas outside of kind of the urban areas for years and years because it's required by law. It's actually a CAL FIRE public resource code. So we've been clearing poles in those areas for years. And then what we're doing now in regards to our wildfire mitigation plan is we're doing additional clearing, and we're doing clearing kind of more on the urban-rural interface. So kind of like right on the outskirts in Wairika, Mount Shasta, all the towns where CAL FIRE doesn't really have governance over the property or over the area, we have stepped up to the plate and we're actually clearing poles in those areas too, where we have the non-exempt equipment. So we clear about 8,000 poles in areas that are governed by CAL FIRE every single year. And then in the areas where it is not mandated by law, we're clearing about 3,000 poles in Siskiyou County. So we're clearing about 3,000 or 11,000 poles a year. And we have a really good a team of pole clearers that have been on the system for years that know the circuits really well. So they've done a really good job with this. Next slide. All right, going back to the helicopter patrols. So Pacific Power also performs helicopter patrols each spring, and so I usually fly with a line patrol man, and he's looking for equipment issues, and then I'm also looking for tree issues. So if you see the picture on the left, we're flying over, I think that's a line that goes from Wairika over to Fort Jones, and the helicopter patrols are great because we can look down and we can spot trees that are kind of hidden behind other trees that maybe a ground inspector could not see from the ground. And so we do this every year, and we do it in the spring, and we try and do it that time of year because we can catch past snow events, past storm events, any conditions that may have been triggered because of storm. And then we capture all the data electronically, and then we also have a ground inspection that follows up beyond us to make sure to check these trees to see if they can hit the lines or for any other kind of further defect that they might see on the ground. So these are conducted kind of on the higher voltage lines. There's two that straddle. They go from COPCO all the way down to where we drop into Pacific Gas and Electric. And then we have several lines that go in and around all the COPCO areas, and a few lines that go, there's one that goes to Happy Camp, and there's two lines that go over the Fort Jones, Callahan area. Right. Next slide, thank you. So Pacific Power has also been partnering with different agencies on fuel reduction projects. And this has been great partnering with several different agencies. The picture on the left is one where we partnered with Shasta Trinity National Forest, and they were doing a huge fuel reduction project along Highway 89. And they were also looking at reducing shade and ice along the highway. And we had power lines in the area, so where their contractor felt uncomfortable falling trees outside of our right-of-way, we came in and helped perform the work to ultimately achieve the goal there. And then the picture on the right is the Lake Shasina area, and that was a CAL FIRE fuel reduction project, or an access project, where they cleared 100 feet from the road for emergency vehicle access during wildfires, and we had power lines within that 100 feet. And so we partnered with them, and we cleared out any vegetation near our power lines to make sure that they met that 100-foot width. And then we've done quite a variety of different projects also with the city of Dunsmuir down in that area. They've reached out to us. There's a lot of homes that kind of border right along I-5. So they've been really worried about people throwing cigarettes or different things out. And so we've also partnered with them clearing out trees between I-5 and our facilities down there. So we've done quite a bit of projects with several different cities and agencies, which has worked out great. And that's all. I think there's one more slide. I wanted to keep it to 10 minutes. I actually had like a 45-minute presentation because there's so much that we do out there. But I wanted to leave some room for questions also and not take up too much time.
Thank you. Anyone from the board would like to start us? What's up?
I got a couple. I get asked this question all the time. What's feasible to put underground and what isn't? And what goes into that? You know, I'll give you an example. The neighborhood I live in, the service lines coming in are above ground. Everything in the subdivision is underground.
Right.
Yet, we've got two power lines running right through the same subdivision.
Gotcha.
That are above ground.
So typically, when Pacific Power installs lines, new lines now, they automatically look to see if they can go underground. But I think it really depends on the customer request and then also maybe the easements that we have in place in that area. And I know there's certain areas where we've been affected by wildfire, where we've had a lot of poles burn down, and we've looked at possibly putting those poles underground moving forward. And it really depends on where they're going to go. So is it on Caltrans property? Is it Klamath National Forest? Is it private? So every process is different. Caltrans is good to work with, but there can be some delays in permitting. There's often environmental issues that we have to work through, like if we go underground, is there certain issues that we're going to impact? Are there archaeological issues? So there's all these steps that they have to take. But typically it depends on the situation. If the customer reaches out and wants to do it, then we send someone that's specialized in that, and they'll take a look at it to see if it can be done. And then with the agencies, it's just kind of a matter of working with the agencies, you know, and is it feasible to go underground where it's at? But often at times, that's one of their biggest, we look toward to doing that because it's easier on us too as far as maintenance. So.
Lorelei, a little quick. And,
right.
I think the other thing is when we do things such as this, we have to justify the cost to the California Public Utility Commission.
Right.
So, so they give us some guidance on what can be underground and what would be acceptable. That was more of Kevin, the presentation before, a couple months ago. He's the one who really kind of gets into that, the legals of what we can and can't do on our fire mitigation efforts. And he looks at that every time. But bottom line is, whatever we choose to do, we have to justify that to the Public Utility Commission to say this was a just and, you know, a high fire tier area and easements and the such gave us the access to.
Yeah, it's just perplexing for me and my neighbors in the standpoint of living probably one of the most high fire prone areas in Scott Valley. Subdivision, you're in there pruning the trees under the overhead lines all the time, but I've got service lines coming to all the houses underground, and it's just odd.
Right.
No,
it's a good question, you know, and you can always call in and see and have someone assess it.
Another question I have, I've managed your right-of-ways before as a public agency official for public lands. Can you explain the difference? Because they're pretty prescriptive, the agreements that you have with the federal agencies as far as clearing things underneath the lines and those kind of things. What's the difference between those right-of-way agreements for hazardous clearing versus the ones you may have, like running through my subdivision?
So the federal easements are more like right-of-way agreements that we've had in place with them for years.
You have a lot of
so they're usually like documents that go for about 10 to 15 years, and then they expire, and then we renew that with that particular agency. But they're very detailed in what we can and cannot do, as far as, you know, do we have the authority to just go in and remove trees under the lines, or do we have to seek permission? There's a lot of environmental hoops sometimes where we might have hazard trees along a certain stretch, and there'll be the spotted owl that's still as sensitive. And so we work with the federal agency. We're moving pretty quickly now with them. They used to be somewhat delayed in some of their response, but I think they understand the urgency nowadays to work a little bit quicker. So each permit kind of goes into the environmental provisions we have to follow, how quickly we can turn things around with them, what we need to provide to them as far as data. And so we've been really working with the Klamath National Forest quite a bit lately, and we're in the middle of developing a full-blown operation maintenance plan with them that doesn't just include vegetation, but also line construction activities. So it's very different on federal lands, and we have particular permits. You know, state parks, we have a different permit that we work through with them. And then on public property, each property usually has a specific easement or deed with that property. I have to say, though, sometimes there are really clear easements that say we have the ability to go in and remove trees, prune anything within the right-of-way, remove trees out of the right-of-way, and then sometimes there isn't quite clear language with the vegetation management. So it really varies property to property. So talking back, you know, about refusals, like I talked about earlier, when we do have a refusal, we actually research that easement for that property. So that's one of the first steps we take to see what our actual rights are, because they're extremely different by property, and it really depends on when that home was built and when the easement was constructed between the utility and the property owner. So the private ones are very different. They're very allocated just to that property.
And then one more question, maybe that, Mark, I'm trying to understand how things are as they are, given, first off, my district is largely public land,
right.
You know, probably 85%
yeah.
of it. For which there's power lines running through it, and I don't understand the what may have changed since I managed those, because the and it's of particular importance to me when I push on the agency from a right-of-way standpoint. Historically, the Office of General Counsel for the Forest Service has always considered the right-of-way to be yours, and the only thing that had to occur within it was Forest Service had to designate the tree to remove, because that's covered under the National Forest Management. The rest of it, the NEPA was done when the right-of-way was signed. And I always hear this excuse from the agency, they have to do NEPA. Now, you can enlighten me a little bit about where that might be today versus what's always been standing legal opinion.
Right, so right now, just a good example with the Klamath National Forest, I think our permit had expired a while ago with them, and so we're having to develop a new operations and maintenance plan with them. But they're working closely with us. I want to say we conference once a month to go over the details to get this plan in place. And I got to say, some of the tree removals themselves, due to the impact on some of the spotted owl and some of the endangered species and things like that, what we've done now is if we think that those trees are imminent and they need to be removed, that we'll actually just send them a spreadsheet of all the trees that we've identified, and we move on them. So there's not really that gap anymore. With the agency taking several weeks to say, oh, we might have a nest in this area, we might have, you know, an environmental issue here. So I got to say, they, from the standpoint of expiration, they expire, and then we have to renew them with them, and it usually takes a little bit of time to go through that process. But they've been good about, if we have to complete the work now, we pretty much send them an email with what we need to do, and we typically move forward. And then if we have imminent situations that we find via the helicopter or the ground patrol, we just get the work done. And then we try and contact them within 24 hours to notify them, just in case there is any archaeological or environmental type issues.
I appreciate your frankness. That's my last question. And just what I'm trying to sort out is how much is law and how much is personality.
Right, right. Honestly, you know, I've been here, like I said, 16 years, and there was kind of sometimes a delay in response. But I think Pacific Power was very active in, if we felt trees needed to be removed or pruned, that we would push it through and work with them and say, no, we're going to do the work. You know, we definitely, on the environmental side, we don't want to impact archaeological resources or do anything to the environment. That would be not good justice. But if there's definitely tree work or hazard trees that need to be worked, they've been a lot better with working with us and letting us proceed with the work. And the climate's changed, you know, it's just a different world, you know. I mean, it used to be in the past, but we'll get back to you in maybe a month or so. We need to review this, but it's a lot different now.
I appreciate that. So wildfire is the biggest threat to any one of my communities in my district.
Right.
There's anything I can do to make sure this work is done in a timely manner. I'd appreciate it if you contact me and let me know.
Thank you
for that offer.
Yeah, thank you.
Bill Moore?
No questions.
Yeah. So right-of-ways, especially on public land, they vary in size.
Exactly.
So it could be 50 feet on either side of the center line, 100 feet, and then trees fall, and that could be an arbitrary size tree. So how do you determine within that right-of-way where those, that easement can be big, small, you have a tree outside of that 50-foot line that could fall into a line.
Right.
So what are the rules there? How does that work?
So that's a really good question, because most of the public-private easements are only 20 feet in total width. So if you go out to a pole and you go 10 feet either way, typically on private, you know, residential areas are about 20 feet total width. And then on the transmission lines, the larger lines, the width is a lot greater, 50 feet, 100 feet, depending on the voltage. But there, with the CAL FIRE laws, under Public Resource Code 4293, we're required to fall any tree that can strike. So if that tree is 150 feet tall and it's outside of that 50-foot easement, we're going to pursue that and remove that. And it's kind of interesting, because a lot of our work, I find, is kind of outside of our easement. I mean, we'll be clearing all the trees underneath the lines within that 20 feet. We'll be doing all the pruning that we need to do. And then you have these 150 to 200 feet tall trees that are dying. And so we're constantly actively mitigating those hazard trees. Yeah, so there's CAL FIRE language that the states or utilities are supposed to follow for any trees that can strike.
Thanks.
That's a really good question. We get that quite a bit, you know. If it's outside, do we work that well? If it has the potential to strike, yes. So, great question.
Thanks.
Anybody else? Another question?
Yeah. Sure. Quickly, underneath the lines, like the Lake Chestina photo that you showed, are they masticating the brush or are they removing it in total?
So typically on a project like that, we would have a mower in there and we'd be masticating it down. On different properties where we're removing, you know, multiple trees or doing veg work under the lines, we typically try and chip it. There's been a lot of concern with fuel load now because of wildfires, and so we typically try and chip what we can, and we chip anything up to 6 inches in diameter. If it's a cross-country line and we can't get a chipper into the area, we often lop and scatter it, and we try and keep it really low and kind of outside the power line easement area. That way, it doesn't have the potential to conduct if a conductor fails or if something happens, and you lob it down really low. And then some landowners ask us to pilot because they would like to burn it. So there's kind of a variety of different situations we deal with the thing of. But we try and do a pretty good job of masticating or lobbying scattering just to keep that fuel low down.
Is there a reason you just don't pull it all together so that you don't have this 5-year or 3-year coming back in trying to redo it?
As far as pulling all the brush out?
Yeah.
You know, we're actively pursuing removals on the cycle work that I mentioned, so every 3 years. But I think from a cost standpoint, too, we're trying to go through and do the fire mitigation work every year. And then we reserve that cycle, that kind of heavier work, for that every third year. So right now, as an example, in Mount Shasta, we're doing a huge circuit that covers most of Mount Shasta and the outskirts, and we're actively pursuing anything underneath the conductors and removing trees.
And on the map that you showed for Mount Shasta, we've done some North Dunsmuir being high or extreme. How does it get that?
The rating?
The rating, yeah, because I mean, I can look otherwhere places that are similar, and they're not in that. So
I know, I get that question a lot, and it's kind of interesting. There was a lot of agencies that were involved with the CPUC when they created those maps. So there was a variety of different agencies, and they looked at wind speeds, they looked at fuel and vegetation, and then they also took into consideration a lot of topography and different environmental factors. And I think one of the other things that drove kind of that area near Weedon Mount Shasta to be higher was a population center. So they kind of emphasize that area because of that. If that wildfire ignites, it'll impact more people and resources.
And then lastly, it's interesting that you to do undergrounding, you sounded like you still need approval from the CPUC, which is kind of bizarre. You'd think they would be promoting that at this point rather than yet having another stick. So that's just a comment. I'm sorry you have to do that, but
right. It
doesn't make a lot of sense. But it's regulatory, I get it.
Exactly.
So, thank you.
Yep, you bet.
Thank you. We're going to go on to public requests, item B, Grenada Irrigation District.
I'm Rod Doss, the Grenada Irrigation District, and previously we've come requesting to have a special election because we missed the cycle, and that was kind of a mess at that point. Went through the process, hired a law firm to help us navigate the proper notices and protocols, done so, and the two current board members were the only two that applied back for the position, so we're requesting that they be reappointed.
So move for reappointment of Elvin Beckman, Terry Smith.
I'll second that.
Wendy.
All righty. Supervisor Howe.
Aye.
Supervisor Kobseff.
Aye.
Supervisor Chris.
Aye.
Supervisor Ogren.
Aye.
And Supervisor Valenzuela.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, just for the general public's information, I'm going to...
Possible to take a quick break before
the
next
one? Yes, I will take a quick break.
Appreciate
if I can finish my spiel.
Wendy. Yep.
When we come back, I'm going to do the what is an act to, we have a request of someone to get in and out, and then we'll continue with the regular scheduled items. How's that, Wendy?
I appreciate that.
All right,
so it's one of the public hearings, right?
Yes.
Okay.
We'll do both of them.
Both of them. Okay. Thank you.